Chapter 4. Is Chinese Society Modern? Zhou Taofeng, one of the best-known journalists in China in the 1920s, wrote an essay under the title of Equality in 1927. Not every person's natural intelligence or strength is equal, but if each person develops his mind towards service and morality so as to contribute to the mass of humanity, then he can be regarded as equal. That is real equality. Modern societies, both dictatorships and democracies, betray the idea of equality all the time, yet they're still committed, in their most basic rhetoric, towards a society that breaks down hierarchies and aims, even if imperfectly, towards equality as a goal. Chinese society has changed in myriad ways in the past century and more, whether it's the nature of landholding, relations between men and women, or between countryside and city, or in the duties and obligations owed by state and people to one another. This chapter examines some of these areas to ask how far Chinese society has become modern, and whether this is at odds with, or complementary to, maintaining its identity as distinctly Chinese. Men and women. One of the most important areas where that search for equality has been fiercest is the changing roles of men and women. Mao Zedong famously said that women hold up half the sky, a rebuke to the generations of Chinese men who had regarded women as their inferiors. However, it would be wrong to take the assessment of Mao and other 20th century revolutionaries at face value, and simply to regard the women of late imperial China as an undifferentiated, oppressed mass, or to assume that the modern era has brought Chinese women today an uncomplicated liberation. How far has the role of women changed in Chinese society since the imperial era? Unbound feet has been the enduring metaphor of the change in the status of women in China between the pre-modern and modern eras. From the 10th century onwards, for reasons that are still unclear, the fashion developed for Chinese women to have their feet tightly bound from an early age, distorting the shape of the foot and leaving it shrunken unnaturally small for an entire lifetime. In some ways, this was surprising, as Confucian norms frowned upon the mutilation of the body. Yet the trend spread, and by the 17th century, the writer Li Yu wrote of the women of Lanzhou in western China, "The feet measure at most 3 inches, some even smaller. Lying in bed with them, it is hard to stop fondling their golden lotus. No other pleasures of dallying with courtesans can surpass this experience." Not all women bound their feet. It was not the custom among peasant women of the Hakka sub-ethnicity, nor among Manchu women during the Qing dynasty. But for the vast majority of women who aspired to respectable life, it was essential. A mother who did not bind her daughter's feet was doing her a disservice, for ugly, huge, that is, normal feet, would mean little prospect of a good marriage. Opportunities for women were restricted overall in imperial China. They could not join the bureaucracy, nor were there many opportunities for them to become traders. Confucian culture did regard women as intellectually less capable than men. However, in the late imperial era, it was quite normal for well-off families to insist that women were literate. In particular, elite women during the early Qing, the 17th and 18th centuries, developed a public voice of their own in one particular area, publishing. This period coincided with a growth in mass woodblock publishing, chapter 6, and women writers of the era took advantage of the existence of a new readership to make their views and interests known. The Ming dynasty had seen a culture of literate courtesans become part of the elite culture, whereas by the Qing, new norms of sexual control meant that chaste womanhood, widows in particular, was praised. Yet the latter change did not end the phenomenon of women writing about their own lives. The great Qing administrators, Chen Hongmo and Yuan Mei, were strongly in favor of literary education for women, even while affirming their belief in women's inherent lesser abilities. However, there was still a genuine shift in the late 19th century, which saw a significant breakdown in the hierarchical relationships between men and women, in particular, poor women who would not have shared in the elite written culture of their richer contemporaries. There developed a considerable intellectual movement in favor of women's rights. Kang Youwei, one of the most prominent reformers of the late 19th century, and a Confucian in his assumptions, proposed a new society in which men and women would be equal and marriages would operate on one-year renewable contracts. Mao Zedong, in the early days of the New Republic, published a succession of essays in Changsha analyzing the fate of Miss Zhao, a young woman who had committed suicide rather than enter a forced marriage, and describing her dilemma in the most uncompromising way. Chinese parents all indirectly rape their sons and daughters. This is the conclusion which inevitably arises under the Chinese family system of parental authority and the marriage system in which there is a policy of parental arrangement. Periodicals such as The Ladies' Journal and The New Woman and essays on the woman problem in the journal New Youth were published in China's major cities. The idea of the new woman, autonomous, professional and urban, was a global one during the interwar years, visible in places as far apart as the US and India. However, it was notable that in China, many of the feminist texts relating to the new woman and her role were written by men. This reflected a tendency that would recur throughout the century. The role of China's women was frequently controlled by men, however sympathetic the latter may have been. In less sympathetic cases, feminism was considered a moral failing. In 1927, nationalist activists on the lookout for leftist activists considered women with bobbed hair to be dangerously subversive and deserving of arrest or execution. Nonetheless, the late 19th and early 20th centuries did bring about a variety of changes in Chinese society that did ultimately change the status of women. The most significant social change, and one that affected society at all levels, and in both city and countryside, was the ending of the long-standing practice of foot binding, which was no longer practiced by the 1920s. Beyond the ending of foot binding, however, the majority of social changes for women in pre-1949 China were concentrated in the city. As the concept of the new woman became well known among urban elites, the character of Nora, from Ibsen's play A Doll's House, became a powerful role model. Nora leaves home at the end of the play, abandoning her husband and children to find an independent role for herself. Yet society as a whole changed less quickly than the aspirant Noras would have wished. The writer Lu Xin asked the pointed question, what happens after Nora leaves home? Even so, there were opportunities that had simply not been there a few decades before. Women became journalists, lawyers, and students. Education, particularly at university level, was the preserve of a very small number of people of either sex, but university radicals were at the heart of feminist thought of the era. Even mainstream politics found a role for women. The communist movement made great play of its commitments to gender equality from its earliest days. The reality was not always so clear. Xiang Jingyu, the most prominent woman in the CCP in the 1920s, found that her feminist concerns were repeatedly sidelined so that the party could accommodate the prejudices of rural men who were its primary target at that time. Although the Nationalist Party in government from 1928 did little fundamentally to challenge gender roles, it did give women citizenship rights and, theoretically, equal rights to status in marriage and inheritance. Poorer urban women found opportunities in the massive social change of the era. As capitalist modernity brought factories to China's cities, in particular Shanghai, rural women were recruited from the countryside to work in the factories that made the silk and cotton cloth that underpinned the textile industry. These jobs were backbreaking and dangerous and paid little, but they marked a move for ordinary women from the confines of the village cottage industry, linked to their families, to a more autonomous urban way of life. For women still in the countryside, however, change would be much longer in coming. The single most devastating event of China's 20th century, the Sino-Japanese War, or War of Resistance to Japan, changed society from top to bottom. This included the destabilization of the settled village society that still dominated rural China. In the areas controlled by the communists, the conditions of wartime were used to create radical social movements that would eventually reshape China in the post-war era and in which traditional gender roles would be further undermined. In 1949, the CCP's victory overturned heaven and earth. The following decades would be an ambivalent time for Chinese women. The Great Leap Forward ended up causing China's most devastating famine of the 20th century, and it is this disaster by which its effects must ultimately be judged. However, it also marks the period when women's roles were most notably equal. The Cultural Revolution, in contrast, offered a much more ambivalent view of womanhood. Although it stressed social equality and took delight in breaking down boundaries, the Cultural Revolution's stress on violence and radical change swiftly made it clear that it took masculine values as its default. Women were shown in the vivid socialist realist posters of the era wielding rifles. Men were not shown feeding babies. In addition, the unbearably close attention that was paid to people's private lives during the Cultural Revolution led to prurient accusations, often against women, every bit as censorious as those of the pre-modern era which Mao had condemned. Even so, there were more women party officials and individually paid workers in the economy than at any other point in Chinese history. The era of reform after 1978 saw a loosening of society in all areas. For women and men alike, some of the claustrophobic restrictions of the Cultural Revolution were removed. Romance was no longer a sign of bourgeois backsliding, nor was wearing stylish clothing or makeup. Yet the social egalitarianism of the earlier era gave way in part to a type of paternalism familiar from the past. Within the party, the number of women party officials, both at local and elite level, dropped dramatically. In the labour market, women often found it harder to gain jobs because their prospective employers assumed they would swiftly leave to have children and did not wish to make provision for this eventuality. The CCP did a significant amount to enforce the rights of widows and daughters to an equal share of inheritance, but even today, especially in rural China, pre-modern assumptions that males have priority in inheritance remain powerful, even though women could inherit property in some circumstances in late imperial China. Most notable of all, the era saw the arrival of the one-child policy. Worried about the exploding population growth rate, in 1979 the government placed severe restrictions on the number of children that a family could have. Although the regulations changed somewhat from their initial version over the years, the general rule was that one child was permitted for an urban family, and that rural families might have a second child if the first was a girl. The policy was justified on demographic grounds, yet it also put a severe question mark over the government's commitment to equality. First, the onus was put squarely, if not explicitly, on women to prevent pregnancy, making it a personal, biological responsibility from which wider society, and men in general, were excused. Then, permission for rural families to try again if the first child was a girl effectively admitted that the old Confucian hierarchies in the countryside were unchangeable and that the desire for a boy first and foremost should be indulged. The mixture of old attitudes and new technology in China led to unforeseen and potentially damaging effects. The use of ultrasound to find out a child's sex before birth has led to large numbers of abortions of female fetuses, leading to a severe gender imbalance in parts of China. The policy had another effect that will only be seen in future decades. China is rapidly aging. Around 140 million Chinese are elderly, that is about 10% of the population in the early 21st century. By 2025, UN estimates suggest that there will be 326 million Chinese over 50 and fewer than 278 million under 20. For these reasons, in 2015, the policy changed to allow two children for any couple who wished to have them. War and society. Confucian norms stressed the importance of harmony and order. This was an understandable reaction to the times that Confucius lived in the era of the warring states, when kingdoms wrestled with each other for supremacy. The terrain of China has been marked, since the 19th century, by war and conflict, the literal battles often shaping the metaphorical ones which have influenced the wider society. The experience of almost constant warfare shaped China from the Taiping Wars of 1850 to 64 until the establishment of the People's Republic in 1949. Even then, Chinese society was not truly at peace for decades. The Qing Dynasty, from its foundation in 1644 to its zenith in the 18th century, took part in massive expansion of Chinese territory to the west and south. These were wars of conquest, however, rather than being internally disruptive civil wars or foreign invasions. Just as Britain fought abroad for colonies in the 19th century, while its metropolitan societies remained peaceful and prosperous, the High Qing era did not see conquest linked with domestic collapse. The wars of the mid-19th century onwards were very different. Late Qing China had a variety of problems that would have come to prominence anyway, such as a major agricultural crisis and an outstripping of the state's ability to collect revenue. However, the impact of war hastened the state's collapse. The famous First Opium War did not in fact cause much social instability in its own right, as it was fought mostly on the coast and at sea. Its importance was in demonstrating the reversal of power between the Qing Empire and the British. A series of later wars caused much greater direct impact, however, such as the Taiping War of 1850 to 64. Warfare did a great deal to corrode Qing authority. In physical terms, it destroyed the agricultural base in some of China's richest areas, further reducing the state's ability to generate revenue. In psychological terms, it enforced the idea that central state authority was no longer strong enough to protect people from attack. Local elites, many of whom had been instrumental in forming local militias, which had eventually helped defeat the Taiping, became a new source of power that became an alternative to the government in Beijing. Eventually, that local power would undermine the Qing fatally in 1911. In fact, the dynasty's downfall in 1911 was less violent than many revolutions, although there were notable atrocities such as the murder of Manchus by Han Chinese revolutionaries in cities such as Nanjing. However, the new Republic of China was racked by war throughout its existence, so much so that many reformers summarized the country's troubles as imperialism from outside, warlordism from within. Civil wars racked the country from 1916 onwards. The establishment of the nationalist government in 1928 was supposed to bring the period of warfare to an end, but in practice, Chiang Kai-shek's government was still at war through most of the following years, with the communists, with rival militarists, and then with the Japanese. These wars were not just passing phenomena. Peasants found their crops confiscated or destroyed, and faith in central authority remained scanty. It did seem possible, by the mid-1930s, that Chiang's government was on the way to consolidating its power. The communists were on the run after the Long March, and Chiang had managed to establish an uneasy truce with most of the regional militarists who had acted against him. But the outbreak of war with Japan in 1937 put paid to any hope of modernization under a centralized, stable state. Reform required peace, stability, a reliable tax revenue stream, and access to international and domestic markets. The nationalist government had none of these. The result was a state that turned in on itself. Corruption, black marketeering, and runaway inflation in the nationalist zone led to a collapse of trust in the government, paving the way for the communist victory in the civil war which followed in 1946-9. The poor record of the nationalist government in the last years of the war has rightly been blamed for the loss of support from the Chinese public. However, this explanation cannot stand alone without an understanding of quite how thoroughly the war against Japan had destroyed the basis of the society which the nationalists governed. On the other hand, one undeniable change did happen in both nationalist and communist areas as a result of the war. The state became entwined with society much more inextricably. The political parties demanded that their people support them in their struggle against Japan. In turn, refugees demanded food, and ordinary citizens expected protection from air raids, and more widely, the establishment of a society that would reward them for the sacrifices they had made during the long years of war. Mao's victory in 1949 has generally been regarded as the end of the period of war in China, as the country was finally united under a single government. Yet the organization of Maoist China was, in significant ways, war by other means. The Cultural Revolution saw pitched battles in the streets of cities such as Shanghai and Chengdu, and the feud with the USSR saw society and economy placed on a war footing in case of invasion. Not until the reform era did society return to something genuinely like peacetime as understood in most liberal societies. It's understandable that so many Chinese live in fear, above all else, of Yuan, chaos. The war against Japan has come back to haunt China in recent years. Since the 1980s, the search for a new nationalism that can help to boost the CCP's legitimacy as a party representing all Chinese, as well as promote reunification with Taiwan, has led to a new emphasis on the history of the war years. During Mao's period in power, the war against Japan was downplayed in history books. The nationalist contribution to victory could not be mentioned. China had little interest in provoking a now pacified Japan, and therefore little public attention was paid to Japanese war crimes in China. From the 1980s, however, the post-Mao regime has stressed that the war against Japan was a moment of great suffering, but also of renewal for China. A museum commemorating the Nanjing Massacre was opened in that city in 1985, nearly half a century after the event itself, and films and books began to give a more balanced and thoughtful account of the contribution made by the nationalists to the defense of China. The period around the 70th anniversary of the ending of the war against Japan, in 2015, saw numerous reminders to the Chinese public of the significance of the wartime experience, including books, television programs and video games, along with a major parade in Tiananmen Square on the new public holiday of 3rd of September, timed for the day after the anniversary of the official Japanese surrender on the 2nd of September 1945. Is China a richer society than under Mao? Significant progress in poverty reduction has taken place in China during the reform era. In 2001, infant mortality rates in China were 31 per 1,000 live births, as opposed to 7 in the US and 67 in India. Life expectancy was 70.6 years, compared to 76.9 in the US and 63.3 in India. In the same year, 93% of primary school-aged children were attending school, 95% in the US, 83% in India. There are complexities beyond the headline figures, of course. A survey of data in 2012 revealed that the bottom 25% of China's population controlled just 1% of its wealth. Nonetheless, the Chinese achievement is impressive and has done a great deal to create personal, if not political, freedoms that come from greater economic opportunity and well-being. Much of the countryside has, of course, become richer between the mid-1980s and mid-2000s. During that time, urban incomes increased by 14.1%, whereas rural incomes increased 11%. But the fastest growing group in society is the urban middle class. In 2012, some 68% of all urban households were judged to be middle class, defined as having a household income of between 60,000 and 229,000 yuan. Furthermore, popular aspirations are phrased in terms that make it clear that the old agricultural China is regarded as the past, not the future. A college education, a pleasant city apartment with running water and flush lavatory, consumer goods, electronic equipment, white goods, a car, and services, leisure travel, cable television. New consumers are emerging elsewhere, for instance among the large population of migrant labourers within China, more than 250 million in 2012, from areas of poverty to richer regions, where they seek work in under-regulated industries such as construction. China is undeniably a richer society in per capita terms than it was under Mao, Chapter 5. However, it's also much more unequal. Services such as free healthcare, education, and guaranteed employment that were part of the Maoist social contract were abandoned during the reform era, and increased cash incomes have still often not been enough to compensate for the new, free market costs of hospital treatment, medicines, or local school fees. Is China free? China is often portrayed, in the present day, as the most prominent example of a society that is not free. Since 2014, there's been a significant clampdown in China on websites such as Google. Yet there clearly are other freedoms that have made a real difference to the lives of Chinese at all levels of society. To understand the significance of these freedoms, one must ask what concept of freedom had previously existed in pre-modern China. In late imperial China, the state was widespread but relatively shallow. Local magistrates, provincial governors, and bureaucrats of various sorts kept the network of the empire running, but its active reach into the lives of ordinary Chinese was much less strong than the increasingly intrusive state of the 20th century, which reached its apogee in Mao's China. For poor rural farmers, just as for the poor of London or Paris, there was little freedom to act because economic deprivation limited the scope for action. Yet, as in early modern Europe, there was also less active state interference in people's lives than in the 20th century. Economic freedom helped shape pre-modern China, with a sophisticated market economy allowing land to be bought and sold, and the ability to accumulate capital allowing business ventures to form and prosper, even though the economy was not mechanized or industrialized in the way that its European equivalent was. People and goods were generally free to travel around the empire, although the trade in certain key goods, such as grain and salt, was heavily regulated. However, the freedoms of political action which are associated with the aftermath of the English, American, and French revolutions are not so easy to detect in pre-modern China, just as they would have been hard to find in much of Central and Eastern Europe, Russia, and the Iberian Peninsula at the same time. The education and immersion into elite values that characterized scholars and officials also made them subject to the moral rules of Confucian governance, and in particular, their duty to speak out when injustice was done by those in power. Nonetheless, the Chinese system did not institutionalize protection for those who spoke out in this way, and that could make open dissent a morally virtuous but personally perilous undertaking. The usage of law in modern China has been one way to assess how free the society has been. The republican state was much more tied to the European idea of constitutions and codified law than the Qing Empire had been, because its structure was so heavily influenced by Western and Japanese models. The republic was not a strong state, even under the nationalists, although it was more stable and promising than later historiography has tended to acknowledge. Chapters 2 and 3. Ironically, though, this failing was a blessing for personal freedom. Unlike the Qing, the modern republican state desired strong day-to-day control over its people, but it had insufficient resources to exercise that control. Nonetheless, freedoms were restricted in the republic and became more so under Mao. Even in the era of reform, the cage has only been opened part of the way. China still has very large numbers, probably thousands, of prisoners held essentially for political offences, such as attempting to set up a new party, joining a banned religious group, or placing dissenting views on a weblog. There are highly credible reports that such prisoners are treated roughly and even tortured. However, China today is overall not a totalitarian state, nor a military junta, nor a state run at the personal whim of a dictator. From a Western point of view, China even appears, perhaps deceptively, free compared to, say, many societies in the Middle East. To use Isaiah Berlin's terms, positive liberty in China today is highly restricted. There is no freedom to establish rival political organizations, the media is highly circumscribed and censored, and public protests, although common, are usually shut down fast. But negative liberty, the freedom essentially to be left alone by the state in matters of personal choice, is undeniably strong. The Chinese of today are free to set up businesses, wear clothes as they please, buy consumer goods, and travel, though not live, where they wish within China, and even go to many places outside it. These freedoms are restricted by economic capability and by corruption, which prevents a truly free set of choices being made. Nonetheless, these freedoms have a real impact. In the Cultural Revolution, wearing leather shoes or Western hairstyles could lead to attacks from the Red Guards. Markets were almost entirely controlled by the state, making events such as the Great Leap Forward possible. The freedoms, such as the growth in market information, that prevent such events happening again, are less romantic than the inspiring Goddess of Democracy statue hoisted by students in Tiananmen Square in 1989, but they are important, and their enactment has not been without risk for the CCP. This is not to accept at face value the CCP's self-serving argument that only it can decide how far and how fast China can safely liberalize. But today's China relates to its people in a very different way from the state under Mao. One of the major factors that's marked the growth of freedom in post-1978 China is exposure to the outside world. Before 1949, China was highly internationalized, and its modernity was shaped by constant interaction with the outside world, often in the unwelcome form of imperialism. The Mao era saw China look inward more and more, and even the USSR was unwelcome after the Sino-Soviet split of the 1960s. Since 1978, however, China has embraced the outside world with enthusiasm. The Tiananmen Square tragedy of 1989 looked as if it might put a stop to this process, but in fact it proved only a temporary obstacle. In the early 21st century, the Chinese are once again a globalized people in their homeland as well as around the world. Chinese students are among the largest communities in the universities of the US, the UK, and Australia. Chinese tourists are a common sight in Bangkok, Paris, and London. Chinese academics regularly visit the West for conferences, and Chinese businessmen do deals on six continents, in recent years finding new opportunities in Latin America and Africa. In the 1980s, there was an expectation that many of the Chinese students who went to the West to study would choose to stay there. Now, it's far more common to find entrepreneurs whose ambition is to return and set up a firm in China's burgeoning market. Books by Chinese business gurus are piled up in the major bookshops of Beijing and Shanghai. For the majority, who cannot yet afford to travel abroad, there are endless television news reports and documentaries on societies in other parts of the world. Foreign television shows are imported and dubbed, likewise foreign films. China is not isolated from the outside world. The arrival of the internet, for instance, has become a very important part of the ability of China's new middle class to engage with the outside world. Many sites, including the BBC Chinese service and sites relating to the Tiananmen Square killings in 1989, are blocked from within China. But thousands of others, relating to foreign films, university courses, news stories, celebrity gossip, and corporations, are not. Many Chinese understand perfectly well the freedoms available in other parts of the world, but they choose not to embrace them, or at any rate, not to embrace them yet. The wider Chinese world opens up intriguing divisions between what is free and democratic. China itself is neither fully free nor democratic. Taiwan, since the 1990s, has been both free and democratic. Singapore, a largely Chinese society, is democratic in that it has regular elections, which are nominally open to opposition candidates, but at high cost to themselves, but is not free. The media and political activism are both heavily regulated. Most intriguing, though, is Hong Kong, which is little more democratic than it was under the British, yet it is a very free society. Although there is growing and worrying political pressure and self-censorship, it has a lively press, it's still common to see books attacking the Chinese government, and it supports a variety of political parties, although the legislature is arranged to prevent any overly liberal party ever coming to power. There are few, if any, other such free, undemocratic societies. One particular freedom that has been vigorously exercised since 1978 is the new freedom to practice religion. Officially, religious freedom was always guaranteed under the People's Republic of China's constitution, but during periods such as the Cultural Revolution, religious practice was condemned as superstition and was politically dangerous. However, in the present day, the state feels that mainstream religion acts as a social glue and no longer seeks to discourage it, instead recognizing state-approved versions of Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, Protestantism, and Catholicism. Christianity has become more widespread. One survey suggested there were some 100 million Christians in 2014, and has found a particular constituency among young urban Chinese who associate the faith with modernity. Around 1.5% of the population of China is Muslim. However, the state is deeply distrustful of religious movements that seem to offer any organization that challenges the government or even seek merely to avoid its surveillance. The Falun Gong movement is one of the best known of such groupings. The passion for improvement. What ties together the themes that characterize Chinese society? Since the violent, transformative impact of modernity on Chinese society from the 19th century onwards, it's clear that China has not been a Confucian society in the pre-modern sense. However, significant cultural influences have remained from that earlier era. Perhaps one of the most powerful, and one whose influence can be found in a wide variety of areas, is the idea of Shouxin, or personal cultivation. The Confucian idea that the way to living a decent and ethical life lay in improving the self with the aim of becoming a Junzi, gentleman, person of integrity, or Sheng, sage. Education is a clear and obvious means of achieving that goal, but contemplation and reflection also make up a large part of it. Although the modern Chinese states of the 20th century tried to distance themselves from what they saw as the backward elements of the Confucian tradition, the idea of Shouxin as a collective, as well as a personal goal, persisted strongly. In the 1930s, as part of a drive for national renewal and in a bid to undermine communist ideology, Chiang Kai-shek launched the New Life Movement, which attempted to drill the Chinese population into regulating its behaviour, Chapter 3. However, despite its failure in the 1930s, there are strong and ever more explicit echoes of the New Life Movement in contemporary China, where points are given by local committees to residents who throw away their garbage and put out plants to decorate their houses. In the run-up to the Olympics in 2008, Beijing residents were told of a new morality evaluation index which would give credit for displays of patriotism, large book collections, and balconies full of potted plants, and lower grades for alcohol abuse, noise complaints, pollution, or a violation of licenses covering internet cafes and karaoke parlors. Public toilets in tourist areas were also upgraded and star-rated. See Figure 9. The idea of suzhou has also taken hold in recent years, a word hard to translate but usually rendered as population quality. To some, it has a faintly eugenic air. Educated Chinese will often claim that peasant suzhou is lower than that of people in the cities, yet an individual's or group's suzhou is not permanently fixed, and education is one means to improve it. The legacy of Shousheng can be seen even through the pseudo-scientific language that surrounds suzhou. This debate also reflects a wider disparity developing in China. During Mao's period of rule, his policies, in particular the Great Leap Forward and Cultural Revolution, were designed to attack, with great violence, the traditional air of superiority that urban dwellers, and educated Chinese in particular, displayed towards the rural population. Mao's introduction of a household registration system to prevent farmers from migrating to the cities undercut this intention, of course. However, the trend has been firmly in the other direction in recent years. Olympics 2008. In 2001, two Chinese obsessions came together: sport and respect. The International Olympic Committee, IOC, announced that the 29th Olympiad of the modern era would be held in Beijing in 2008. The 20th century was marked by the use of sport as an indicator of national prowess. Pre-modern Chinese culture, however, had not regarded physical exercise as the mark of manhood, but rather praised the ideal of the Confucian gentleman, learned and separated from the world of exertion. This changed in the late Qing and Republican periods. Many thinkers, influenced by social Darwinist ideas, felt that China's devotion to scholarship over physical prowess was leading the nation to destruction. Mao Zedong, in his earliest writings, noted that physical exercise should be rude and rough, and even sketched out a personal exercise plan involving buttock thrusts. Nor was Mao alone. China's leaders were aware that its weak international status meant that it had a long way to go to exercise military power in its own right. However, there were other forms of cultural power that could be shown off in the international arena. China sent a team to the Olympics for the first time in 1936, that year held in Berlin, perhaps the most purely political games that the Olympic movement has ever seen. The Cold War was also a sporting war, with US-Soviet rivalries played out every 4 years. China did not compete until the 1980s, but then quickly made its mark in sports such as gymnastics. By participating in the Olympics, China was making a clear indication that it was once again part of the world community. The same motivation fueled the decision in 1992-3 by the Chinese government to bid to bring the Millennium Olympiad to Beijing. Huge amounts of money were spent in the bid, and the result was piped through loudspeakers live into Tiananmen Square. However, the shocked crowd heard that the lucky city was to be Sydney. The unstated but widely felt subtext was that the IOC could not award the Games to China just 4 years after the killings in Tiananmen Square. The international world of sport could not give China permission to slip back into the community of nations as if nothing had happened. However, the 1993 snub proved to be a start rather than an end to the process. Within 2 years, China held a major international event, the 1995 UN Women's Conference. Finally, in 2001, Beijing once again put itself forward as a candidate city. This time, it started as the favourite and never lost the position. By the time the Games started, the killings in Tiananmen Square would be almost 20 years in the past. The China that had been given the Games was no longer a shell-shocked society recovering from an internal social crisis, but a confident regional power with a global reach. For many countries, such as Italy, Germany, South Korea and Spain, the holding of the Olympic Games was a symbolic coming out from a dictatorial past. The message of Beijing 2008 was more ambiguous. Certainly, the Games symbolized China opening itself up to the outside world, a welcoming host to the family of nations. Yet, Beijing 2008 was the first Olympics held since Moscow 1980 in a country that is not democratic. And in the years since then, several other non-democratic societies have been awarded prestigious events, such as the Winter Olympics and the Football World Cup. The Beijing Olympics certainly symbolized China's arrival in the international community. What is more, they did so largely on China's terms and in ways that validated authoritarianism well beyond China. In 2015, the Winter Olympics were awarded to Beijing, the first time a city has hosted both Summer and Winter Games. The only competitor to host them was Almaty, in equally illiberal Kazakhstan. The Other Chinas. This book has mostly been concerned with events on the mainland. However, the main landmass that we know as China has always been affected, and continues to be so today, by Chinese societies well beyond its own borders. Taiwan remains the major piece of unfinished business from the Cold War in the eyes of the Beijing leadership. After the return of Hong Kong to Chinese rule in 1997, reunification with Taiwan moved much further up the political agenda in the rhetoric of the mainland. At the same time, movements within Taiwan itself have given fuel to the idea that the island should declare independence. It remains a commonly held point of view among mainland Chinese that the country will only have full territorial integrity when Taiwan is part of the motherland once more, and that all means, including war, are acceptable to bring about this aim. China's claim to Taiwan dates from imperial times, when the island came under the control of the Qing dynasty. Yet this interpretation of history hides complications. The Qing Empire also contained what is now Outer Mongolia, yet there are no calls for that country to be reabsorbed into China. More crucially, Chinese rhetoric does not call attention to the fact that, since the late 19th century, Taiwan has only been part of a united Chinese state for 4 years, from 1945 to 1949. Taiwan's history is a complex one. Its earliest inhabitants were Malayo-Polynesian aboriginals, and ethnic Chinese settlers arrived there in significant numbers only from the 16th century. The Qing dynasty did incorporate Taiwan into its territory, but as late as the 19th century, the island was regarded, even by the Chinese, as a remote frontier place. The island did not have long to develop under the Qing. The dynasty, having lost the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-5, was forced to cede the island to Japan, making it the first formal Japanese colony in Asia. For the next half century, Taiwanese grew up under Japanese colonial governance. While that rule was patronizing and often harsh, particularly during the war years of the 1930s and 1940s, it was not marked by the brutality seen in Japanese behavior on the mainland. The Japanese succeeded in creating an indigenous colonial elite who spoke Japanese as easily, or more so, than Mandarin or Taiwanese Chinese, and who even today regard their former colonial rulers with ambivalence or even tolerant approval. Former President Lee Teng-hui once declared that he was a Japanese before the age of 22, that is, until 1945. What is also notable is that the turbulent history of China's Republican period, the 1911 Revolution, May 4th Movement, the Nationalist Government, and above all the rise of a powerful Communist Party, had little relevance for the island. Even the most traumatic event of all, the war against Japan, happened off-island, and some Taiwanese fought on the Japanese side, outraging their mainland compatriots. Japan's defeat in 1945 also saw the island handed back to Chinese, nationalist control, and the island's view of their colonial experience became rosier in retrospect because of the harsh nature of what followed. The nationalists treated Taiwan as if they were an occupying power rather than liberators. As the civil war raged on the mainland, the government clamped down yet further on dissent in Taiwan. On the 28th of February 1947, an altercation between the police and an old woman selling contraband cigarettes spiralled into mass protests by the island's indigenous population against nationalist rule. The reaction was swift and brutal, with thousands of Taiwanese being killed or imprisoned. Any discussion of the event was banned, particularly after Chiang Kai-shek fled to the island in 1949, and 228, as the events became known, lay under the surface of the island's memories for decades. After 1949, the island lived in a state increasingly detached from reality as the Republic of China in exile, waiting to take the mainland back from the communist rebels and bandits. Military rule was declared, and the nationalist rulers continued to commit human rights abuses well into the 1980s. Yet, although political dissent was strongly repressed in Taiwan, a very successful economic model was being laid out at the same time. The nationalists tackled one of their great failures on the mainland, the reform of land ownership, a project heavily encouraged by American advisers. They also used governmental power to create an economy driven by exports, in particular consumer goods, leather, wood and paper. During the 1960s, Taiwan's exports rose by around 20% each year, and the economy as a whole grew by 9.2% annually. Most notably, Taiwan moved firmly towards democracy. The 1970s saw new interest groups emerge, including the Tung Wei, outside the party movement, on behalf of which Chen Shui-bian had stood for office. Many of these interest groups advocated more power for the local population of the island, whose interests had been subsumed by the agenda of the mainlanders who had fled to Taiwan in 1949. Chiang died in 1975 and was succeeded by his son, Chiang Ching-kuo, who eventually took the decision to legalize dissent. By the 1990s, Taiwan had a genuine liberal democracy. In 2000, for the first time, the presidency was won by a representative of the opposition, the former dissident Chen Shui-bian. 8 years later, beset by scandal, Chen lost office in turn to his nationalist challenger Ma Ying-jeou. Taiwan's system diverged from that of China at the same time that the relationship across the straits was strengthened in a variety of ways. As China opened up under Deng, Taiwan compatriots were encouraged to visit the mainland and invest in it. At the same time, the CCP became ever more concerned by the number of Taiwanese who no longer considered reunification with China desirable or even relevant, and the mainland made threatening noises about its right to invade Taiwan in the event of a declaration of independence. Yet China has been highly successful in convincing the world of its own position on Taiwan, that Taiwan independence is unthinkable. This is in some ways odd, because Taiwan has not always been such a polarizing issue. It was not central to the territorial rhetoric of the Republican governments or during much of Mao's period in power. Nor is reunification necessary for China's continued economic growth or political influence. Nor, any longer, does the mainland demand that Taiwan become like China. The terms offered for reunification since 1978 have become something like a reunification in name only, involving Taiwan maintaining its own political system and even military. In the 1980s, it was Hong Kong that was more prominent in the news. In 1898, the British had forced China to grant a 99-year lease on the new territories that bordered Hong Kong Island and Kowloon, which had been seized after the Opium Wars. As the lease began to end, Deng Xiaoping's government made it clear that they were determined to take Hong Kong back, but also gave assurances that the colony's way of life would not be altered for at least 50 years. In 1984, a Chinese-British accord formalized the agreement for handover, but two events made the final days before the handover in 1997 much less calm than anticipated. The Tiananmen Square demonstrations of 1989 and the appointment of a democratic politician, Chris Patten, rather than a civil servant, as the last governor of the territory. Patten introduced much wider voting rights in Hong Kong's highly limited elections, infuriating Beijing, who regarded the act as a breach of the spirit, if not the letter, of the handover agreement. There was much speculation within Hong Kong, as well as from business and political circles in Britain, that the reforms would harm Sino-British relations for years to come. In fact, although the wider franchise was abolished as soon as the Chinese took over, neither Chinese rule nor Patten's reforms immediately had the dire effects that some feared. Hong Kong continues to have a strongly international feel, a free business environment, and a broadly free media. Most notably, there is strong popular interest in politics, partly because there are growing fears within Hong Kong about the direction of political travel. A widespread student movement occupied parts of the city in the autumn of 2014, protesting primarily about the attempt to impose a very limited system of election for the territory's chief executive from 2017, allowing Beijing to select candidates who would only then be subject to a popular vote, but also drawing on young people's anger about increasingly limited economic opportunities in the city. The overseas Chinese, that is, the ethnic Chinese diaspora living outside the boundaries of China itself, have always been an important part of the story of China's development. There are distinct communities. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, coastal Chinese moved to California, to South Africa, and to Britain. In the post-1945 period, there was a new influx of Hong Kongers to Britain, and after 1965, when racial quotas were lifted, of Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Southeast Asian Chinese to the United States. From the late 1970s, it once again became possible to emigrate from mainland China, and in the decades that have followed, it has become straightforward for those who wish to emigrate, and can afford it, to do so. Migration has now become truly global and is a commercialized entity with agencies including local governments and, sometimes criminal, snakehead gangmasters all playing a role in the diffusion of Chinese to North America, Europe, Australasia, Africa and Latin America. Migrants also seek education, no longer being content to remain in relatively low-skilled industries such as restaurateuring that distinguished them in the 1960s and 1970s. A modern society? Overall, there are plenty of aspects of contemporary Chinese society that are directly connected to the world of 100 or 500 years ago. Popular religious practice, the preference for male children in the countryside, and the stress on hierarchy among them. Yet other aspects of society could only have been formed in the modern world. The presence in a globalized economy, where labor as well as capital has become more mobile, the stress on the language of equality and rights that comes from a century of nationalist and communist politics, and the notion that the state and the people are, and should be, closely entwined with one another, the latter tendency strengthened by the experience of total warfare, whether against Japan or against class enemies. Modern Chinese society is both Chinese and modern.